It was a high bluff overlooking the dark violence of the swollen river. He sat alone, watched as the men fell into line and the columns began moving slowly through the steady rain. He felt the coolness run down his neck, the water soaking every part of him, his hat, his clothes. A vast sea of mud surrounded them all. The Potomac was rising again, was well beyond their ability to ford, as they might have done before the rains. Now it was angry and swirling. In the darkness, the motion was accented by the small fires that lined the riverbank, a flickering protest to the misery of the weather, the only guiding light the men would have to reach the crossing. Lee straightened his back, stretched, pulled at the miserable wetness in his clothes. He reached down, patted Traveler gently, said quietly to the horse, "He has given us one more night. He has not come." He was thinking now of George Meade, the commander of the vast federal army he knew was encamped out there, somewhere, deep in the thick darkness. He had expected them to come at him well before now. It had been 10 days, and Lee's army had been strung out for miles, moving southwest, away from Gettysburg. The army had begun the march away from the bloody fields in a terrible downpour, led away by the wagons of the wounded, and Meade had not pursued. But they reached the Potomac to find the river swollen nearly out of its banks, their one good bridge swept away, and so they would have to try to build another, or wait longer for the river to drop. When Meade had finally moved, he pushed his army in a more roundabout way to come at them from downriver. But there was too much time. Lee's men had fortified into a strong defensive line, and so Meade waited again. Lee had known the risk was enormous, and he feared the attack at any time. There was some skirmishing, small outbreaks of musket fire, the feeling out of two great armies close together. The only real assaults had been with cavalry all along the march, the Federal horsemen thrusting and jabbing while Stuart held them away from the main lines. When the skies finally cleared and the roads began to dry, Meade moved his army close and Lee was backed hard against the high water. Now they had dug in, the quick work of men with shovels, because even the foot soldiers knew that they were trapped and a strong push from a healthy enemy could crush them. But Meade did not come. It was Major Harmon, the foul-tempered and foul-mouthed quartermaster of Jackson's old Second Corps, who saved the day. Lee smiled now, remembered Jackson's embarrassment as Harmon would ride by, screaming profanities at a line of slow-moving wagons. Jackson would glance at Lee like a small boy, expecting an angry response from a stern parent, and Lee would look away, would make no issue of it, knew well that Jackson would tolerate the man's harsh outbursts because he was very good at his job. Now Harmon was serving new commanders and still did his job. He scouted the countryside, found the abandoned houses and barns, the people far away from this invading army. Harmon ordered the houses dismantled and the wood planking thrown into the river, swept downstream to where the engineers waited. The wood was collected and strung together into a snaking mass of ragged timber. They had laid tree branches across the planks, muffling the sounds of the wagon's wheels, and now the ambulances and the guns and the weary soldiers were finally crossing the river. Lee still watched them, the glow from the fires throwing light and shadows on the faces, some looking up toward him, seeing him on the high knoll, but most stared straight ahead, looked silently at the back of the man in front, or down at the slow rhythm of bare feet, moving slowly, carefully. And they all knew they were marching south.